Good morning. The Healthcare Regulations Subcommittee will come to order. Sabrina, would you please call the roll?
Chair Salzman, Vice Chair Burfield.
Here.
Representatives Bartleman.
Here.
Abbott.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Bell, excuse, Black.
Here.
Botana.
Here.
Chaney.
Here.
Franklin, excuse me. Humchowski, Persons Mulica.
Here.
Rudman.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Tant.
Here.
Trabuzzi, excuse, quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina. I want to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones. As way of an introduction to this week's meeting, the last meeting we heard presentations that identified various healthcare workforce shortages that we are experiencing in the state of Florida. Today, we will learn more about various programs the legislature has enacted over the past years to help address these shortages. We will begin today with a healthcare regulation update by Joe Baker, who is the Board Executive Director of the Division of Medical Quality Assurance within the Department of Health. Mr. Baker, if you come forward, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Are we on? Yes. Thank you, Chair Berman, Ranking Member Bartleman, and committee members. My name is Joe Baker. I have the privilege of serving as Executive Director of the Florida Board of Nursing, and it's my pleasure to appear before you this morning. This morning, I will provide updates on the following workforce programs involving the Division of Medical Quality Assurance: the Autonomous Advanced Practice Registered Nurse, the Nurse Licensure Compact, the Professional Counselor's Licensure Compact, the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, Healthcare Licensure by Endorsement, and Licensing for Military Members and Spouses. Autonomous APRN. House Bill 607 was signed into law in March of 2020 with an effective date of July 1st, 2020. The Board of Nursing registered the first autonomous APRN on October 19th of 2020. Rule 64B9 4.001, a definition of primary care practice, went into effect on February 25th, 2021. This definition is read in conjunction with Section 464.0123(3) of the Florida statutes. Rule 64B9-4.021, Standards for Autonomous Practice, went into effect on October 26th of 2021. The Board of Nursing adopted this rule upon the recommendation of the Autonomous APRN Council. Autonomous practice means the advanced nursing practice by an APRN who is registered with the Board of Nursing and who is not subject to supervision by a physician or a supervisory protocol. APRNs practice within the framework of an established protocol that must be maintained on site at the location or locations at which she or he practices, unless the APRN is registered and approved for autonomous practice. The registration criteria for autonomous practice is the APRN can have no discipline within the last 5 years. They must have 3 hours of graduate level education in pharmacology and differential diagnosis. And the board has determined that an equivalency to those hours of graduate level education is 45 hours of approved continuing education in each of those subject areas. And the registrant must also have 3,000 hours of supervised clinical practice within the previous 5 years. That clinical practice can be met by education provided by faculty in a clinical setting in a graduate program leading to a master's or doctoral degree in a clinical nursing specialty. Primary care practice is defined in statute as family medicine, general pediatrics, and general internal medicine. The board was also directed to define it by rule, as you will see on the slide. And the board further defined primary care practice to include physical and mental health promotion, assessment, evaluation, disease prevention, health maintenance, counseling, patient education, diagnosis, and treatment of acute and chronic illnesses, inclusive of behavioral and mental health conditions. The family nurse practitioner is the largest specialty group of autonomous APRNs reported through their practitioner profiles. $9,332 represents the total number of autonomous APRNs in a renewable status as of June 30th of this year. This number is inclusive of 1,230 autonomous APRNs who do not have a practice location in Florida. 8,102 autonomous APRNs have practice locations in Florida, and all counties have autonomous APRNs with reported practice locations except Lafayette County. And this slide represents the breakdown by county. This slide illustrates autonomous APRNs per capita in each Florida county. Miami-Dade County is home to the largest number of autonomous APRNs per capita, as there are 71.5 of them per 1,000 people. For a population that is over 180 times smaller than Miami-Dade, Gulf County, by comparison, has only 8.8 fewer autonomous APRNs per 100,000 people. The Nurse Licensure Compact. Legislation passed during the 2016 session, which authorized Florida to join the Nurse Licensure Compact, or the NLC. The NLC is an interstate compact that allows a registered nurse or a licensed practical nurse to have a multi-state license in the primary state of residency. The compact went into effect in Florida on January 19, 2018, which was 6 months after the 26th state adopted the NLC, and that was a requirement in statute that the compact not go into effect until 26 states had adopted it. We issued the first multi-state RN license in Florida on January 22nd of 2018. I serve as Florida's commissioner on the compact, and I also currently serve as treasurer on the compact's executive committee. This slide illustrates the current composition of states in the compact as 41 participating jurisdictions. Pennsylvania has now partially implemented their compact legislation. The compact continues to work on legislation in the remaining states to bring about our goal of a compact nation. To receive a multi-state license, a nurse must meet specific licensure requirements such as meet the home state's qualifications, graduate from a qualified education program, pass the National Council Licensure Examination, which is also known as NCLEX, have no active discipline, submit to a federal criminal background check to confirm no felony convictions, and have no current impairment program involvement. This slide illustrates the total number of licenses for each fiscal year broken down by RN and LPN. There are many benefits for our nurses to hold multi-state licenses, such as an increased patient access to care. It enables continuity of care for patients regardless of their location, and it's also cost-effective in that nurses do not have to maintain multiple licenses around the country and can practice across state borders affordably and conveniently. So while not required, eNotify is a tool developed by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing in collaboration with the Boards of Nursing for organizations and nurses who want to receive free automated updates on nurse licensure statuses. Organizations can view their nurse license reports and receive license status notifications and nurses can receive license expiration reminders and track license verifications for endorsement, which is something we'll talk about a little later in my presentation. There are up to 4,255 nurses practicing in Florida on a multi-state license, according to the 38 Florida facilities that are registered in e-Notify to track their licensees. We continue to promote e-Notify as an excellent tool to be used by employers. An update on the compact. We recently approved a rule change that will go into effect on January 2nd of 2024, requiring multi-state licensees, when they change their primary state of residency, to apply for licensure in the new jurisdiction within 60 days. That will help employers enforce the requirement of only having the multi-state license in the state where the nurse currently claims his or her primary state of residence. The Professional Counselor's Licensure Compact was signed into law by the governor on April 6th of last year. To provide counseling services through this compact, counselors use the counseling license granted by their home state or their primary state of residence to apply for the privilege to practice in other member states. Counselors must have an unencumbered license, have taken a national exam, have completed supervised professional experience, and have earned a 60-semester-hour master's degree in counseling. Applications for compact privileges are currently not open. The Compact Commission is working to develop rules and a shared data system, and applications are expected to open in late 2024. Ashley Irving is our board executive director for this profession, and she serves as Florida's commissioner with this compact and is also on the Compact's Rules Committee. Their commission met in October of this year for its annual meeting, where they voted on rules, bylaws, and their budget. Florida was the eighth state to join the Professional Counselor's Licensure Compact, and there are currently 30 member states as of September 1st of this year. Connecticut was the most recent state to enact legislation for this compact. Florida was part of the initial rulemaking of this compact because we were one of the first 10 member states. This compact only applies to licensed mental health counselors. Counselors who hold an unencumbered license to independently diagnose, assess, treat, and practice at the highest level in a participating state may apply for a privilege to practice in the compact. Benefits of this compact. It permits counselors to provide services to populations currently underserved or geographically isolated while improving access to care. It allows military personnel and spouses to more easily continue in their profession when relocating. And it allows licensed counselors to practice face-to-face or through telehealth services across state lines without having to become licensed in additional counseling compact states. It provides consumer protection as well across state lines. The Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact. This compact was signed into law by the governor on May 25th of this year. To practice telepsychology or conduct temporary practice under what is known as the PsyPact, a psychologist must possess an active Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards e-passport credential or certificate, hold a full unrestricted active license in a PsyPact state with no disciplinary action, and hold a doctoral degree from an accredited program, as well as successful completion of the examination for professional practice for the practice of telepsychology. PsyPact is operational in Florida, and interested Florida licensed psychologists started applying through the Interstate Compact Commission as of July 1st of this year. As of August 18th, we have had 244 individuals approved for telepsychology, who were those who selected Florida as a home state, and 8 for temporary practice. If a psychologist license in any home or another compact state is restricted, suspended, or otherwise limited, the psychologist will not be eligible to practice telepsychology in a compact state. SciPact went into effect on April 23rd of 2019, when the eighth state joined, has been enacted by 40 states, and is effective in 39. Florida was the 39th state to join this compact and the 38th state where it became effective. Benefits of the SciPact include increased patient access to care. It facilitates continuity of care when the client patient relocates or travels, and it demonstrates psychology regulators' responsiveness to issues such as portability, continuity of practice, and public protection. The SciPact Commission is meeting this week, which is the first meeting where a board member from the Board of Psychology will participate as Florida's commissioner. Licensure by endorsement. This slide indicates the difference between endorsement, compacts, and reciprocity. Generally speaking, licensure by endorsement refers to a process of a state granting a license to an applicant who is licensed in good standing in another state. The endorsement model recognizes the due diligence of the other jurisdiction and affords the applicant a more streamlined licensure process without having to undergo significant additional training, work experience, or examination, and only be required to complete state-specific requirements. For example, some healthcare professions require a state-specific laws and rules exam or certain continuing education courses to be completed. A compact is when a certain number of states agree upon a uniform standard of care and requirements and enact state laws to support that standard. Generally speaking, a compact allows a healthcare practitioner to obtain a multi-state license in their home state and practice in the other member states. Reciprocity is another licensure pathway by which a healthcare license is obtained in one state and may be accepted as valid in another state by prior agreement without reexamination. Florida does not have any healthcare reciprocity agreements. This chart illustrates the total number of endorsement applications that were received and approved in the last fiscal year. As you can see by the chart on this slide, registered nurses comprised the largest number of endorsement applications that were approved in fiscal year 22-23 by a wide margin at over 14,000, and they were followed by medical doctors, licensed practical nurses, and radiologic technicians. Endorsement applications were approved on an average of 1.4 days in the last fiscal year. Licensing for our military members and spouses. The department is committed to serving members and veterans of the United States Armed Forces and their families, and is proud that over 1.5 million veterans call Florida home. It is our continued goal to make Florida the most veteran-friendly state in the nation. The department is committed to honoring veterans, active duty service members, and their families. By implementing special fee waivers and expedited licensing, the department can better assist service members and their families as they grow in their career, wish to practice while stationed in Florida, or settle in Florida at the end of their service. In 1997, a provision was enacted that allowed active duty military members to place their license on military status, which keeps the license in good standing without requiring the service member to renew or pay renewal fees during the duration of the service member's active duty service. Beginning in 2011, additional military pathways began to evolve, including a pathway for military spouses to obtain a one-year temporary certificate to practice their profession while their spouse was assigned to a duty station in Florida. We saw significant expansion of military pathways in 2014, which included our expedited license for recently discharged or soon to be discharged active duty service members. Qualified applicants simply must show an honorable discharge and proof of practice for at least 3 years on an unencumbered license. There is no fee for this application. Additional fee waivers were applied to veterans and spouses who are honorably discharged within the last 60 months. In 2014, a temporary certificate to practice in an area of critical need was also established for active duty commissioned medical officers and veterans who served at least 10 years. And this is for our medical doctors and osteopathic physicians. In 2016, a temporary certificate was established allowing for active duty military healthcare practitioners to practice on a military platform. And a military platform is defined as a military training agreement with a non-military healthcare provider that is designed to develop and support medical, surgical, or other healthcare treatment opportunities in a non-military healthcare provider setting to authorize a military healthcare practitioner to develop and maintain the technical proficiency necessary to meet the present and future healthcare needs of the United States Armed Forces. In 2022, the fee waiver and licensure for active duty member spouses law was also modified so that they could receive a full license to practice while their spouse is assigned to a duty station in our state. In the last fiscal year, the department issued 14,574 licenses to qualified military members and their spouses on an average of 1.2 business days. More than 15,000 fee waiver waivers were received, resulting in a savings of over $2.2 million. The top professions for veterans, spouses, and active duty members are registered nurse, emergency medical technician, licensed practical nurse, paramedic, and registered pharmacy technician. So what's new for our military members and their spouses? House Bill 139 from last session established the Office of Veteran Licensure Services within Medical Quality Assurance to provide information, guidance, direction, and assistance with healthcare licensure processes for all veterans and their spouses. It also requires Veterans Florida to assist veterans and their spouses with access, training, education, and employment in Florida's healthcare professions. The department has hired Staff Sergeant Sam Tyler as the Executive Director for the Office of Veterans Licensure Services. His military career was built on the development of new projects and programs, and he is a champion for connecting veterans to resources in the Sunshine State. Thank you to the legislature for passing this bill, as we are very excited to soon have this concierge office fully operational to serve our military members and families. And we're glad to have Mr. Tyler here in the audience this morning and look forward to working with him at MQA as we move forward with that new office. Senate Bill 274, Nursing Education Pathway for Military Combat Medics. The Department of Education's Articulation Coordinating Committee, the ACC, was directed to convene a work group to establish a process for prioritizing and determining post-secondary course equivalencies and the minimum credit or clock hours that must be awarded in an accredited nursing education program for military training and education required for service in specified positions. This process must be approved by the Board of Governors of the State University System and the State Board of Education with recommendations due to them by December 1st of this year. The ACC is to approve a list of post-secondary course equivalencies and credit and clock hours awarded for these courses and training, which must be approved by the BOG and the SBE in the statewide articulation agreement. State universities, Florida college system institutions, and career centers will award credit or clock hours based on the approved list. And additionally, the bill revised a primary goal of the Florida Center for Nursing to provide that under its strategic statewide plan for nursing manpower, the encouragement and coordination of the development of partnerships must include partnerships with hospitals that include opportunities for nursing students to obtain clinical experience. Our Florida Health Heroes. Our newest publication was released by the division on Veterans Day, November 11th, and the report highlights healthcare practitioners who have served in the United States Armed Forces and provides resources for Florida's military service members and their families. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Do we have any questions? Okay. Representative Rudman, I think you had a question you wanted to ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director Baker, for that presentation. And I especially wanted to thank you for the shout-out you gave my Military Combat Medics Act. That was, in my opinion, an important piece of legislation, and thank you for recognizing that. Before I ask my question, if I can start with a premise. So I want everyone to know that I employ nurse practitioners. There are nurse practitioners running my office while I am here in the legislature. So I am a friend of nurse practitioners, and I want that known. But let's ask a question. If we could go back to slide 3, that would be great. When we talk about the autonomous nurse practitioners. So again, taking my personal philosophy out of the equation, as a legislator, I wasn't around in 2019, 2020 when this happened, but I would hope that people were looking at this from two sets of criteria. Number one, the fact that we want nurse practitioners with a great deal of experience. And also, I would imagine that the legislature was hoping that they would be willing to practice in underserved areas. So my question has to do with their experience. You notice there at the bottom of the slide, to become an autonomous nurse practitioner, we ask that they have 3,000 hours of supervised clinical practice. And that's over a course of 5 years. Now, what that means, supervised means they're working under a physician like myself. Well, when I did the math this morning, 3,000 hours basically correlates to 1.5 years of supervision. Now, when the state of Florida granted me a medical license, you guys didn't turn me loose on an unsuspecting public until I had 3 years of supervision, and that's an absolute minimum. There are physicians that go for 7 years of extra training. So I guess my question is 3,000 hours enough? Should that bar be raised to protect the health and safety of our Floridians?
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
At the department and the board, we have implemented the current law, which requires the 3,000 hours.
Follow-up?
Well, and I guess the other possibility, because again, in my personal experience, my nurse practitioner, he has 20 years of experience as a paramedic, as an ICU nurse. So there's lots of ways a person can get experience. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone looking over their shoulder. But I was surprised to learn that there are no uniform standards across these nurse practitioner schools. In other words, depending on the program you apply to, they may say that you need just very minimal experience to become a nurse practitioner. Is there anything in statute that we currently have that enforces a minimum uniform standard?
Mr. Baker.
The current requirement in statute for licensure as an APRN is a master's level or higher degree from accredited institutions.
Representative Cheney. You have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair Burfield. Thank you for your presentation. Very, very comprehensive. I appreciate the recap. And the only thing that we haven't touched on yet, it seems, as a legislature, is the dental health space. And I was just wondering if there were any thoughts on helping with the dental workforce, since so many studies show that dental health impacts heart disease, diabetes, other things like that. So are you waiting for direction, or are there any thoughts within your agency?
Mr. Baker, you can answer, but we do have a follow-up, a presentation that's going to be given today on dental, regarding dental. Does anybody else have any questions? Representative Franklin.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks for this presentation. Very insightful. My questions are also around metrics, and the reason why I ask this question, you know, I am a supporter of increasing access to healthcare, of course, and there's this theory called the, you know, iron triangle, saying if we increase access, we decrease quality. If we decrease cost, we decrease quality. And as we know here in America, we spend the most money on healthcare, but we don't have the best outcomes of healthcare. So my question is, as we are increasing access to Floridians to have accessible healthcare, do we also have any metrics to follow outcomes to see if we're truly moving the needle forward in reference to keeping and helping keep Floridians healthy?
Mr. Baker?
I think that would be within the purview of the Florida Center for Nursing, which I know recently gave a presentation as well to your committee. That information related to workforce and things like that is what they study and report on through the Florida Center.
Representative Rudman for another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Director Baker, like I said, I think we should focus on nurse practitioners' experience as well as their willingness to practice in an underserved area. If we could go back to slide number 5. There we go, the APRNs by numbers. Is there any current requirement in statute where an autonomous nurse practitioner must practice in an underserved area?
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
No, sir.
Follow-up question, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any way of tracking, so when you look at that graphic, is there any way of tracking currently in the legislature or through the Board of Nursing, Board of Medicine, whether these nurse practitioners in these counties are actually taking insurance? Are they taking Medicaid where we really need their services? Or is there any way of telling if they're just doing concierge medicine, which is usually cash only?
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
We do not track that information. That's something we could perhaps discuss with ACA to compare our databases to see if that data could be pulled, but we don't track that currently.
One follow-up.
One final question, Madam Chair. Thank you. And so when I look at that graphic, Director Baker, I'm looking at the Florida Panhandle because that's where I practice. I practice in Santa Rosa County. So I don't really know if this is a question or a comment. I would be interested in seeing that graphic in a different relationship. So you have Escambia County to the far west. You have my county, Santa Rosa, next to it, Okaloosa, Walton, and then that last one, which is kind of light blue, that's Bay County. I think it might be more telling to maybe separate those counties from, split them into halves. In other words, you have the coastal region, which is where the high-paying insurers are, and then you have the areas to the north. You know, as you're getting close to Alabama, that's really where we need the services. So when you put up a graphic that says we have somewhere between 100 and 500 nurse practitioners in Escambia County, I can promise you 498 of those are in Pensacola. They're not where we need them. They're not in Century, Florida. And the same goes for Santa Rosa. They're in Navarre. They're not in Jay. They're not in Munson. In Walton County, they're not in Dufuniac Springs. They're down on Destin and down on 38 where they can make millions of dollars. Is there any way we can get an updated graphic which would break those four counties down into specific regions?
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. I believe we can break that down using zip codes to get that information.
And if you'll send that to the staff, then we'll make sure it gets out to everyone. Representative Bartleman, excuse me.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question just because it's... You have one county that has zero nurse practitioners. Can you tell me a little bit about that county? Do you have, like, as a state legislator, I'm concerned. Do you have a community-based health clinic there? Is there a hospital? If you live there, is it? I don't even know which county that is by looking at the graph.
Mr.
So can
Baker,
you let me know about that county?
It's Lafayette County, and this does not have an autonomous APRN with identified practice location in that county.
Can I follow up?
Follow.
Please? So you're the Department of Health. So does it have? community-based care centers? Does it have a hospital? Does it have doctors? I found it interesting that it's the only county in the state without anything, and I'm wondering what services is that county getting?
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
And we can get that information to you.
Thank you.
Anybody else have any questions? Mr. Baker, I did have a question. You mentioned when you were talking about the professional counselor's licensure compact that they would not be able to practice in any other of the compact states if they were suspended or restricted. However, you didn't mention anything when you were talking about the APRNs or you were talking about the nursing licensure compact. How does that oversight work? What are the protections that are in place for the citizens?
It is the same with the nurse licensure compact, and we utilize our national database called NURSIS to track all of that information. All of the boards contribute their data to NURSIS, and we communicate with each other electronically. And so whenever one board takes any action, we are immediately notified. So say they have a multi-state license and the home state acts upon it, the other states find out about it as well. So we track it through the national database.
So once you've been notified, what is the action that the department would take at that time?
We would potentially open a simultaneous complaint to analyze if the board needs to take action. Because within the nurse compact, the home state that issues the license can discipline the license, but also if the infraction took place in Florida where they were practicing on the privilege, we would be able to discipline the privilege to practice in Florida.
Okay. And one other quick question for you. As we have expanded or we have provided different opportunities for licensure in the state of Florida, have we seen a reduction in the shortages in these specific areas? So have we been meeting the need in a more effective manner?
And that is what is a challenge for us to track in nursing and the e-notify service that I referenced. If we can get more and more employers enrolled in e-notify, then we have more data on the number of nurses who might be working here on the privilege to practice of, say, they have a Georgia multi-state license, but they're working across the line. We don't have all of that data right now as much as we would like until we can get more institutions participating in e-notify.
And what is the cost for a business to participate in that system?
It's free.
Thank you. Representative Skidmore for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is a little bit of the inverse of Rep. Bartleman's question, I think, because I'm looking at Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade, obviously a very populated metropolitan area, as the place with the highest number of APRNs. The concern I have is there are 8,000, a little more than 8,000. What is the population of them in those three counties? Because the volume on the lightest color, not zero, but the next lightest color is 1 to 25. Then you jump 25 to 100. Then it's 100 to 500. Like the gap keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So it would appear that the concentration of the APRNs is in the place where we least needed it.
Mr. Baker, you're recognized.
And we can pull that data as well if you'd like for those three counties to dig a little deeper into them.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, Mr. Baker, thank you so much for joining us today. And if you will get that information to our staff, then we'll make sure to get it out to the committee as a whole.
We will do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Members, next up is a briefing on the various student loan repayment programs available to healthcare professionals by Emma Spencer. As you all will recall, Dr. Spencer is in the division, is the division director for the Division of Public Health Statistics and Performance Management within the Department of Health. Thank you for joining us. You're recognized, Dr. Spencer.
Good morning. Oh, it's over here. I'm sorry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Burfield and members of the committee, thank you again for inviting me to talk to you today. We do appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the student loan repayment programs related to our healthcare workforce. So I just want to start with a brief look at the status of medical school debt. Nationally, more than 72% of medical school graduates have education-related debt, with the per-person debt for physicians in 2019 being just over $200,000. Three out of four medical school students use federal loans to finance their debt, which leads to a sum of $3 billion in new annual debt. This background can give us some perspective on the importance of medical school debt and the need for the Florida Reimbursement Assistance for Medical Education, or the FRAME program. The FRAME program encourages qualified medical professionals to practice in underserved locations of the state through the provision of awards aimed at reducing medical education-related loans. The healthcare practitioners who are able to participate include allopathic and osteopathic physicians, physician's assistants, advanced practice registered nurses, as well as registered nurses and licensed practical nurses, and autonomous practice nurses are also included. The legislature has provided $16 million in reoccurring general revenue funding annually since fiscal year 22-23 to be awarded through the FRAME program. During the first cycle of the FRAME program, the Department of Health received medical school debt information from all of its applicants. Physicians had the highest level of debt, with the average reported debt for the FRAME physician applicants being $255,000. The total loan debt reported by FRAME applicants was $318.6 million. The table also provides more information on the number of applicants, total debt, and the average debt for all of the different types of FRAME applicants by practitioner type. Florida statutes defines the limits for awards per practitioner type. Physicians can be awarded up to $20,000. Autonomous practice APRNs can be awarded up to $15,000. APRNs and PAs may be awarded up to $10,000. And RNs and LPNs can be awarded up to $4,000 per year. FRAME focuses on three areas in determining awards. These areas include the number of direct patient care hours that the clinician serves in primary care health professional shortage areas, or HPSAs, plus the primary care HPSA score where the practitioner actually serves, and plus the length of time the practitioner has served in the primary care HPSA. HPSAs, for reference, are federally designated areas that designate shortage areas for certain healthcare professionals, facilities, or populations, and are provided a score based on indicators such as provider to population ratios, percent poverty, and infant mortality. This HPSA score provided the basis for the prioritization of the practitioners that we awarded so that those serving in the most underserved areas ranked the highest. Additionally, an allocation method as determined in the FRAME rule allowed the highest prioritization score to be assigned to a quartile, which enabled the program to provide an additional 60 awards during the 22-23 cycle. During the 22-23 award cycle, there were 3,702 submitted applications to the FRAMEworks portal. And of those submitted applications and those that met the program eligibility requirements, a total debt from these applications was reported to be $40.8 million. The program provided awards to 39% of the accepted applications before fully expending the program budget of $16 million. Florida provided 1,097 awards during the first cycle across all eligible healthcare practitioners. You can see how these awards are distributed among the participating practitioner types. Physicians receive the bulk of the awards, with 62.7% of the total awards being distributed to this healthcare workforce category. The distribution of the award amount for each practitioner type is also provided on this slide. Of the 1,097 awards, physicians received 81% of the total available funding, or just under $13 million. Nurses of all types received a total of just under $3 million out of the 16. For reference, in the first year of this program, we were able to award, thanks to the $16 million provided to providers who served in 21 out of the 32, or 65% of the rural counties noted in the state. That's 56 awards, or just over $580,000. The FRAME anticipated application window will be open from February 1st through March 31st each year that the program is funded, and all applicants must create an account and complete their application via the FRAMEWORKS portal. Within the FRAMEWORKS portal, all information is provided to assist and enable the practitioners the ability to apply to the program. Additionally, in May of 2023, the FRAMEWORKS portal received a Best of Florida award for the best application serving the public at the Digital Government Summit. So I have discussed the FRAME program. I would like to discuss several additional initiatives going forward. One new program that will be administered by the Department of Health's Primary Care Office and will be also branded under the FRAME umbrella will be implemented because of the 2023 legislative session. This program is the Dental Student Loan Repayment Program, which is established in Florida statutes and states that the department shall establish a dental student loan repayment program to benefit Florida licensed dentists who demonstrate active employment in a public health program that serves Medicaid recipients and other low-income patients and is a dental health professional shortage area or in a medically underserved area. This new FRAME dental program will promote access to dental care by supporting qualified dentists who treat medically underserved populations in dental HPSAs. And just for reference, there are 266 dental HPSAs in the state. Eligible dentists may receive up to $50,000 to offset their dental student loans and are also eligible to receive an award up to five times. The first cycle of FRAME Dental is projected to open in February of 2024. With this, we aim to provide up to 37 awards for the first cycle of the FRAME Dental program. The last two slides of this part of the presentation feature additional programs to help address the issue of student debt associated with medical professions. The Florida Department of Education sponsors the Nursing Student Loan Forgiveness Program. These awards are available to nurses serving at an eligible employment site, and these nurses may receive up to $4,000 per year and may participate up to a maximum of 4 years. Just to note, nurses are not able to participate both in the Department of Education's Nursing Student Loan Forgiveness Program and FRAME at the same time. They can only participate in one. We have a reciprocal agreement with the Department of Education to verify applications across both programs. The National Health Service Core Loan Repayment Program is a federal program sponsored by HRSA, and the Primary Care Office of the Department of Health provides technical assistance to practitioners and site applicants to help match and work through the application. The NHSC program provides scholarships or repays the educational loans of approved and eligible primary care physicians and other healthcare providers, such as nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, dentists and hygienists, mental health professionals, and certified nurse midwives who agree to serve in a minimum of 2 years at an NHSC-approved site, which is also located in a federally designated HPSA. The awards are up to $50,000 for a two-year initial full-time term, or up to $25,000 for a half-time service. Currently, Florida has 691 National Health Service Corps participants. And a practicing practitioner participating in that program is actually eligible for the FRAME program that I mentioned earlier. So this concludes my portion of the presentation. And I'd like to turn things over to Jessica Sapp from the Bureau of Healthcare Practitioner Regulation, unless you would like to take questions.
Actually, if we can go ahead and take some questions real quick. Representative Redman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Spencer, thanks for coming to see us again. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, the FRAME program. I'm very appreciative of it and what we're trying to do for our providers here and our nurses in the state of Florida. I did have a question, though. Can you tell us what the average physician award is? I saw the general number and the number of applicants. Do we have an idea of how much money we're actually reimbursing or repaying these physicians?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized for an answer.
Thank you. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can bring it back and get it right for you.
Recognized for a follow-up, Representative Roman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one final question. So obviously, you could probably tell from my comments, there's directions that I feel we shouldn't be going in, and then there's something such as this, a direction I feel is very important. We really should move further in this direction. So to that end, I wanted to ask some specifics about the award prioritization. I'm looking at slide 6. And Dr. Spencer, if you could educate me on exactly how this works. Like, where is the applicant at the time of application? And I can give you some background. So in the state of Mississippi, what they do, when you are accepted into medical school, the state will come to you and they'll say, hey, we'll pay your tuition on the front end if you will sign an agreement that you'll practice in the Mississippi Delta. Now, it's a contract you can break. If you break it, you just owe them the money back. But it looks to me from this slide that we actually want them in place first. And once they're there, they then have to calculate how hard they're working, how poor is the area. Am I correct in that? Can you kind of walk us through how the process works in the state of Florida?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Great, thank you. That's a great question. Yes, so we do get attestation signed by the employer. That's one of the documents that is required when you are applying to the program. And that does, include that you are currently employed in that facility, in that location, and also attesting to the number of patient care hours that you serve. And those are all part of this prioritization score.
Representative Redman, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Dr. Spencer. Any opinion on my comment earlier about how the state of Mississippi does it? Would it be better maybe to offer the award on the front end? That way you're enticing people who might otherwise choose a different pathway. Maybe someone wants to be a physician, but because they're unaware of this award or they can't get it until the end of the process. Any thoughts on maybe moving this towards the front end like the state of Mississippi does?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Thank you so much for that question. We have implemented a rule that works towards identifying all of these factors. And I can't speak to what Mississippi does, only what Florida does. And so we likely would have to assess that rule.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Spencer. I think I saw that it was 39% of the applicants received an award, pardon me, before the $16 million was depleted. What would it take to fully fund the program?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized.
Thank you. So we were looking at the number of people who applied. So there was 3,700 individuals who applied to the program, and we were only able to fund 1,097 of those before we fully expended the $16 million. of those, they had a reported debt of $40.8 million. So likely we would have to do an assessment of exactly how much we would need, but just those are the numbers that we have received.
Second question.
Representative Skidmore for a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got a little confused, and I probably missed connecting the dots. The reimbursement rate for MDs and DOs is $20,000, but then the reimbursement rate for dentists was $50,000. Is that accurate?
Dr. Snyder, you're recognized for a response.
Yes. So per statute, the physicians are up to $20,000, and then in the dental loan repayment program statute, the dentists can receive an award of up to $50,000.
Representative Skidmore for a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the average debt of a dentist higher than an MD or a DO?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized for a response?
Yes. I can give you that number if you like. I actually have that one on the top of my head.
Yes. Please do.
It is just over $290,000 per graduate.
Thank you. Representative Abbott, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Spencer, for that presentation. Can you tell me what percentage of the frame awardees, with those practitioners, what percentage of them came from or graduated from a Florida program?
Spencer, you're recognized for a response.
I do not have that information to hand, but I can get that to you.
Representative, for follow-up.
On the frame dental, I want to make sure I was correct and I heard you. They are mandated to take Medicaid, correct?
Yes.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions related to the frame program, if that's okay. And thank you for your presentation. Thank you for being here, Doctor. I was hoping you could elaborate a little bit more about the qualification. So when you say that the program is designed for professionals that are practicing in underserved areas, how is that defined? What is the definition of an underserved area? And then the second part of that question is on slide four, there's a list of the applications. Is that a comprehensive list of all the professionals that qualify?
Dr. Spencer, you recognize the first response?
Great, thank you. So I'll answer your second question first. Yes, that is the list who are by statute able to apply to the FRAME program. And then the first question about a medically underserved area, we are using the health professional shortage areas, also known as HPSAs. Those are federally designated. They are designated based on a few indicators. The ratio of physicians to people and infant mortality and also... percent poverty level, sorry. And then I got there. That score is generated in a geographic location, and it's based on population, facility, or number of providers. And there's also dental HPSAs, mental health HPSAs, and this one we're using primary care HPSAs.
Representative Tant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In respect, I have two rural counties in my district in the Panhandle. I have a question about the underserved areas. Does it track? We saw the graphic that Mr. Baker presented with the light blue to dark blue, and then the no practitioner rural area. Does it track the same for doctors? Are there also a lack of doctors in those same areas? And do we have it broken down by numbers of doctors per those areas of underserved, like we do the nurses?
Dr. Spencer, you're recognized for a response?
Yes, and I can provide that data. We had a map to that effect in our last presentation, but I'll have
I'd like to see that again. Yeah. Thank you. I'll go back and look in my notes. I have it in the office. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Franklin, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks for your presentation here, and thanks for also administering this program, which is so critical to ensure that underserved populations have quality access to healthcare. My question is around, I'm a pharmacist by trade, so naturally I noticed that pharmacists weren't involved in any of these frameworks whatsoever. And I do know, knowing quite a few rural hospitals, rural clinics, whether it's ran by the county or if they're, you know, federally qualified health centers. And even when I talk to CVS and Walgreens, we talk about the shortages that are critical for them to be able to provide services to their communities. And obviously it's important for doctors to diagnose and nurses now doing hybrids between diagnosing and administering, but also we need medications and people being able to manage those regimens. Has there been any thought around kind of doing some studies of HEPSA areas for pharmacists, and any thought around why or why not, or consideration to look at adding the pharmacy profession within any of these frameworks?
Thank you. That is a very good question, and I would like to be able to dive into that myself. So I don't, I have not heard, currently the HPSAs are related to mental health and dental and primary care, not pharmacists.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you so much for joining us today and providing this presentation. Members will also make sure that we get with Dr. Spencer on the maps and other pieces of information you've requested. Thank you very much. Our final presentation today will be on licensure pathways for the areas of critical need by Jessica Sapp, who is with the Division of Medical Quality Assurance within the Florida Department of Health. Welcome, Ms. Sapp. You're recognized to speak to us about the licensure process.
Hi, good morning, Chair Burfield and Ranking Member Bartleman and committee members. My name is Jessica Sapp, and I serve as Practitioner Regulation in the Division of Medical Quality Assurance. And I'll be presenting on our healthcare professions that have established licensure pathways to allow practitioners to practice in areas of critical need or underserved areas. These professions include dentistry, medicine, and our mental health professions. The Dental Practice Act in Section 466.0067 establishes the Health Access Dental License to attract dentists to practice in underserved areas and allow out-of-state dentists who meet certain criteria to practice in health access settings. To qualify, a dentist must apply to the board and demonstrate they've graduated from an accredited dental school, have passed their national board exams and a clinical dental exam. They must have a license in good standing from another state. They have not been convicted of a crime related to practice. They must have been engaged in active clinical dentistry practice for the last 5 years, complete 30 hours of continuing education, and have passed the Florida Laws and Rules exam on dentistry. Once licensed, a dentist can practice their profession in a health access setting, which is defined by statute as you see on this slide. Limited licenses are established under Section 465.015 Florida Statute, which is the umbrella chapter for all of our healthcare professions. The intent is to license retired healthcare practitioners to serve the indigent, underserved, or critical need populations and give healthcare healthcare boards permissive authority to adopt rules to permit practice as limited licensees. The statute requires an individual to apply to the board and provide an affidavit indicating that they have been practicing in another state for at least 10 years, that they have retired or intend to retire, and they will only practice pursuant to the restrictions of the limited license. A dentist or dental hygienist may practice their full scope of practice, but can only practice in the employ of public agencies or institutions or nonprofit agencies or institutions that meets the requirements of Section 501(c)(3) of the Internal Revenue Code. A limited licensee may provide services only to the indigent, underserved, or critical need populations within the state, and the standard for determining indigency shall be recognized by the Federal Poverty Income Guidelines produced by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Physicians may serve the critical need populations through two licensure pathways, by obtaining a temporary certification for areas of critical need, also known as an ACN license, or limited license. An ACN license is intended to address critical physician specialty, demographic, or geographic needs for the state's physicians workforce. Section 458.315 Florida statute allows the Board of Medicine or Osteopathic Medicine to issue an ACN license to an individual who holds an active license as a physician in another state and can demonstrate practice for at least for the last 3 years and intends to practice only in an area of critical need. A physician who's been issued this license may practice their full scope, but only in a county health department, a correctional facility, Department of Veterans Affairs Clinic, a community health center, or other agency or institution that is approved by the state Surgeon General. As with dentistry, the Board of Medicine and Osteopathic Medicine have also established rules to allow physicians to obtain a limited license. The statute requires an individual to apply to the board and provide an affidavit indicating they've been practicing in another state for at least 10 years, that they have retired or intend to retire, and that they will only practice pursuant to the restrictions of the limited license. The Board of Clinical Social Work, Marriage and Family Therapy, and Mental Health Counseling, as well as the Board of Psychology, have also established rules to allow practitioners to obtain a limited license. Again, as required by statute, the same requirements apply, which include providing an affidavit indicating they've been practicing their profession for 10 years, and that they have retired or intend to retire, and that they will only practice pursuant to the restrictions of the limited license. This slide illustrates the number of practitioners, including dentists, physicians, and our mental health professionals serving in areas of critical need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that presentation. I know I rolled in the middle of it. I want to say a big thanks to my vice chair, who was my chair in action this morning. She's been a great partner, and I'm sure she'll be doing that for us a lot as we go through the process. So with that being said, members, are there any questions? You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just have two questions. My first question is, when they get this license through the alternative pathway, is there a requirement they have to stay in those areas of critical need, or is there a time frame where they can stop serving them?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Yes, they're required to practice in those areas of critical need under this license.
Indefinitely.
Correct.
Thank you. Second question?
Follow-up. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. And this is just, my antennas went up when you said this. It's not in your slide, but you mentioned that as long as they didn't commit a crime in the area of their practice. I'm just curious about that, because if a teacher has a traffic crime, they have to report it to the state. So if they commit any other crime, as long as it's not in the area of practice, it's okay. How does that work?
You're recognized.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. For these applications, for any of our applicants who apply for any of our healthcare professions, some of our professions are required to be background screened, not all. However, they have to answer a series of questions relating to criminal history on their application. Depending on how they answer those questions, depending on what the crime is, that's reviewed by each individual board to make that determination.
Follow up.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Why do we not background screen people as a practice, as a best practice, before we allow them to come into our state and work with some of our neediest Floridians?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Our background screen professions are outlined in statute, and it only includes specific professions.
Thank you.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was really interesting to learn about the limited license. I was not aware that the state of Florida had such a program for doctors and DOs and MDs. And so if we could, there we are, right there, the limited licensee. So my question was, since I was unaware of the program, how many applications do we normally get per year for that? Do we have a lot of people taking us up on that offer?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. I don't have the application numbers handy on each of these slides. You'll see the numbers. As of right now, we have 172 physicians who hold the limited license. On the dental slide, we have 123 dentists, 19 dental hygienists. That's how many number of licensees we have with that type of license.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of along the lines of what Rep. Bartleman was saying, is there any way of knowing for certain that they are serving the purpose for which they were intended? So, for example, in Walton County, there's a big difference between Dufuniac Springs and 30A. So once they agree to practice in Dufuniac Springs and you give them that limited license, how do we know they're not spending a half day a week in Dufuniac and 4 days a week down on 30? Is there any kind of enforcement or any type of regulation, oversight, just to be sure that they're fulfilling the purpose they promised?
You're recognized.
Sure. Thank you for that question. At the time they apply, they have to provide an affidavit and a letter from their employer stating that they'll be practicing in that type of setting as well as at renewal. For the ACN license for our physicians, not only do we verify that at renewal, but in between those renewal years, there is an audit done to ensure they're practicing in those areas.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final question, because you mentioned a word that kind of touched a nerve on me. So I'm a solo family practitioner. I don't have an employer. So are the only people eligible for the limited license, are they employed physicians? What if you have a retiree from, let's say, Memphis who wants to come down and open his own practice in Dufuniac? Would that be allowed?
You're recognized.
Thank you for the question. So the types of settings are very specific. For example, for physicians, they have to be in a county health department, a correctional facility, Department of Veterans Affairs. So we would obtain a letter from that entity.
Members, are there any more questions? Anyone else? Awesome. Well, the legislature has taken numerous steps in the past. Oh, yes, sorry. Look, I did this last time, too. I'm not very polite. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, committee members.
We appreciate you. All right, so we've taken numerous steps in the past to combat healthcare workforce shortages, and unfortunately, we know that we're going to continue to see those shortages persist and increase in the future. So this session, we will look at ways to expand existing programs and develop new approaches to address this issue. I look forward to working with each of you in this endeavor. This includes our subcommittee agenda, and Representative Tant moves that we rise unless there is an objection. Upon motion of Representative Tant, the meeting is adjourned.